I'm not as tall either. So it's great to be here. We're, like Danny said, we live in Niger. We're here on vacation, and also for the happy occasion of Annika and Roberto's wedding. But also vacation, because this is home for us, and a big reason why this is home is because of Narkis Street and because of all of you. So it's good to see you all. And when I come on vacation, I don't get to relax. I have to preach. So here we go. Today, I wanted to talk about the idea of God's kingship. Kind of a couple of things, but that's sort of the main theme. And it fits in nicely with the reading that we did this morning. I think we think often about God as king. And it's a phrase that we throw around a lot. We hear it in songs, you know, God is sovereign. But I don't know if we really always think about what it really means or what the full implications of that are. So I wanted to look at that a little bit. I think if you look in the Bible, the original plan that God had for his people was to be their king, to rule over his people directly. And that's something that you see also throughout the Bible, but especially in the Exodus narrative. God set his people free, and he led them out of slavery in Egypt through a pillar of fire and smoke. So that was a very visible and tangible entity that the people of Israel followed around and that ruled over them. And he gave them laws, concrete laws on Sinai. So God made the people of Israel into a people, but also into his people, by liberating them, giving them the law, and leading them into the promised land. But it didn't take very long, of course, until the people of Israel revolted against God, who was also their king. That's why the word revolt, I think, is appropriate. In fact, they were barely even out of Egypt. They still had the whiff of slavery clinging to them. When they took the gold that God had wanted to bless them with and melted it down into a golden calf. And this act of idolatry is, I think, symbolic and representative of the other acts that were to follow in Israel's history, not only because it was the first post-liberation, but also because of the imagery is so striking. God liberated his people from slavery, and they took the gold and the blessings that he wanted to give them, and they fashioned it into new chains for themselves. And created a new form of slavery for themselves. And this idolatry wasn't just a new form of slavery, but as you said, it was a rebellion against God. It was done in defiance of the king, and it was seen by God as an attempt to replace him. It was a revolt, and God made it clear that when it comes to kingship, it's really a zero-sum game. So I don't know, some of you maybe watched the show Game of Thrones. There's a great quote, I think it's from the first season, when they say, when you play the Game of Thrones, you win or you die. And that's sort of the sentiment, I think, when God says, I am your God and you'll have no other gods before me. So that might sound a bit tyrannical to us, a bit heavy-handed, but I think it's actually liberating, and that's what we heard this morning also. Because God's purpose is to set us free from the slavery of idolatry that we're all drawn to. And he wants to rule over us as a king, but as a king whose kingdom is one of justice for the oppressed and healing for the sick and freedom for the imprisoned. And so this connection between the idolatry and slavery is seen also throughout the Bible, but it's made explicit really in one small story that we're not going to read, but if you remember the story of the slave girl who was set free by Paul and Timothy in Philippi, I think is in Acts 16. Physically, her body was possessed by her masters, and spiritually, her soul was possessed by an evil spirit. And her masters were exploiting her for profit, and they were mad when the Spirit of God set her free. And that story just always reminds me of some of the kids that we see in Niger. Sometimes the parents send them out to beg in the street because of their disability. And that's how they make money. So the parents don't actually want them to be healed. Sometimes the kids want to be healed and the parents don't let them. Or they also have the, they call them the talibe. It's like kids that are that come to an imam, kind of like a madrasa, where they're supposed to learn, you know, like Quranic school. But they don't learn. They just send them out into the street to beg. And many of them also have disabilities. And it's really a system of exploitation. It's interesting, actually. Senegal, the president of Senegal recently just spoke out against the whole talibe system and said he wanted to disband it. And I mean, that's also a Muslim country. So that story reminded me of the situation of those children and this connection between slavery and idolatry. And the pursuit of false gods always leads to slavery. So I think it's interesting connection. And I just finished reading The Guide for the Perplexed by Maimonides, the Rambam. It's kind of a big book. I don't but some of it was really interesting. And he talks a lot about idolatry in that book. And in fact, he claims that the whole purpose of the law was really to train the people of Israel away from idolatry. So that also ties in with what we heard this morning. It's not an easy thing to retrain the habits and customs of a whole people, but that's why the law was written, to set God's people on the righteous path and help pry them away from their idolatrous behavior. And it's not easy, because we rebel against God, we turn away from Him, and He's calling us back. And His call is a call to freedom. But we're drawn towards slavery, I think, for a number of reasons. For one thing, I think it's easier than freedom. Freedom is hard, and it implies choice. And for the most part, we're happy to surrender our freedom and our choice and reject the hard freedom of the desert in favor of the meat and melons of Egyptian slavery, to carry that analogy forward. But something else also draws us towards slavery, I think, our pride. We believe that the lie that we're self-sufficient and that we don't need God or anyone else to help us, because we can help ourselves. Just as the people of Israel quickly forgot who had liberated them from slavery and who had brought them into the promised land, we forget that ultimately we depend on God for everything. And this, of course, ties back into idolatry. In Isaiah 2:8, we read that the land was full of idols and the people worshiped the work of their own hands. And that's obviously talking about idolatry. They're idols that were fashioned by our own hands. But I think it's hard not to also think of our modern day adoration of technology, and the way we see human accomplishments and achievements as the definitive solution to problems that have plagued mankind since time began. This, to me, is the definition of hubris, and it's a form of idolatry that I think we're particularly susceptible to in the Western world, but I think that the tendency is a human one, and it leads to the conclusion, I don't need God, or we don't need God because we have things. And if you think I'm exaggerating, just pick up an issue of Wired magazine, or listen to the way people talk about their iPhone. If you don't hear a hint of idolatry in that, you're not listening. God made it very clear to His people that He was king. But eventually the people of Israel, as you all know, wanted a different king. And even though that wasn't the original plan, He agreed, but He wasn't happy about it. And He gave them a warning, saying that they were willingly submitting to a new yoke, to a new form of slavery. This is in 1 Samuel 8, 10 through 18. I'll just read it here. Samuel told all the words of the Lord to the people who were asking him for a king. He said, "This is what the king who will reign over you will claim as his rights. He will take your sons and make them serve with his chariots and horses. They will run in front of his chariots. Some he will assign to be commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties. Others to plow his ground and reap his harvest. And still others to make weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers, cooks, and bakers. He will take a tenth of your grain and of your vintage and give it to his officials and attendants. Your male and female servants and the best of your cattle and donkeys he will take for his own use. He will take a tenth of your flock, and you yourselves will become his slaves. When that day comes, you will cry out for relief from the king you have chosen, but the Lord will not answer you in that day." And as you all know also, that's basically what happened with the kings, with the kings of Israel. And it reminds me in a way of the post-colonial rulers in Africa, I guess elsewhere as well, but that's where I'm most familiar with. The rulers in the newly independent African states, you know, they wanted independence from their colonial overlords, the British and the French, and they struggled for it and they got it. But in many instances, they just traded one master for another. If you think of Mobutu in Congo or Iadima, who was the president and president for, I think, 39 years in Togo, where I grew up. It's sort of the same way with the kings of Israel, with Solomon, really just a new pharaoh, but dressed as a king of Israel. Same slavery, but a new master. And we all know the story of the people of Israel, the failure of the kings and the eventual split of the kingdom, the destruction, the dispersion, the exile. And you all know how the thread of idolatry is woven throughout this history like a disease that's regularly treated but keeps coming back. But it's interesting because at least in the beginning, and even then only occasionally, the people of Israel actually did try at least to take the idea of God as king seriously. And of course, it wasn't very revolutionary to view a king as a god or a son of a god. Lots of ancient Near Eastern kingdoms and empires did that. But that's very different from viewing God as your king. It's much easier to deify a king that you see before you than it is to surrender everything in a physical sense to a god that you do not see. So I think others may have seen their kings as gods in some sort of symbolic or cosmic sense, but not in a political sense. And that's what the people of Israel attempted to do. And the book of Judges, which I want to look at a little bit today, is sort of a chronicle of that attempt. Ultimately, of course, the attempt was a failure, and it ushered in the era of kings. But I think it was an honest attempt, and I think it's interesting to look at, and it has a lot to say to us. So I wanted to look in particular at the story of Gideon, which was sort of a small victory for this idea of the kingship of God, which is easily overlooked, maybe, because of the general defeat of this concept. Even though we know the way things ultimately turned out for the people of Israel, we do have this story of Gideon, which is sort of a shining example of someone who stood against the general trend of history, against the temptation to regress towards slavery, and who said, "God is my king." So I'm not going to read the whole story, because I'm sure you all know it. But it follows a very familiar pattern in the Bible. The people of Israel were oppressed. This time it was by the Midianites. And they cried out to God, and God raised up Gideon to fight against them. And they won a miraculous victory. But when you look at this same story that's maybe familiar with these themes in mind, the kingship of God and the problem of idolatry, you kind of see that idolatry and this rebellion against God was sort of at the root of the whole problem with the Midianites. So I just want to read in Judges 6, 7 through 10. "When the Israelites cried out to the Lord because of Midian, he sent them a prophet who said, 'This is what the God of Israel says. I brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. I snatched you from the power of Egypt and from the hand of your oppressors. I drove them from before you and gave you their land. I said to you, I am the Lord your God. Do not worship the gods of the Amorites in whose land you live, but you have not listened to me.'" So basically, they forgot about their own God who had freed them from slavery and followed other gods. And in essence, they had chosen another king. Therefore, it's not accidental, I think, that if you continue on in the story, the first action that Gideon took when he was going to liberate his people from the Midianites was to destroy the idols, to destroy the Baal and the Asherah poles. And that's in the same chapter, Judges 6. And it's interesting because on the surface, these idols didn't have anything to do with the Midianites, who were the actual enemies. But it's clear that the people of Israel couldn't be free from the weight of oppression without first throwing off the chains of idolatry. And it's just an interesting side note, but as most of you know, even in modern Hebrew, the word Baal sort of signifies owner or master. And as Jesus said, you cannot serve two masters. So this first strike against the slavery of the people of Israel, it not only earned Gideon a new name, which was the fittingly iconoclastic Yerubbabel, which means someone who fights against the Baal, but also exposed the people's slavish devotion to their idols, because they were actually upset with Gideon because of what he had done, and they wanted to kill him. But eventually they realize that he had done something good, and a sort of resistance against the Midianites forms around Gideon. And the Midianites were defeated in battle, and the people of Israel were freed from their oppression. And because of this, they wanted to make Gideon their king. And I think it would have been easy for Gideon to take credit for this miraculous victory, but he said no. And politicians always say no, they're not going to run, you know, in a campaign. That's the surest sign that they are planning to run. But that's not what was happening here. The people legitimately wanted Gideon to be their king, and he probably was tempted by the thought. But in the end, he gave the perfect answer to them, which is in Judges 8. I'll just read it. 8:22-23. The Israelites said to Gideon, "Rule over us, you, your sons, and your grandsons, because you have saved us out of the hand of Midian." But Gideon told them, "I will not rule over you, nor will my son rule over you. The Lord will rule over you." So he basically said, "No, I won't be your king, because you already have a king. And I can't be your king without rebelling against God, who is your king." But even though God had saved them, the people of Israel wanted more security. They wanted a God that they could see. And what is that but a king? They wanted something tangible. And if they could no longer have their idols, they would have a human king, which is basically the same thing. And all of this, I think, is motivated by fear. And as we've already seen, people are willing to surrender anything, including their freedom, when they're motivated by fear. But what were they afraid of? On the surface level, I think they were afraid of the Midianites, the oppressors, anyone that would attack them or steal from them or make their lives difficult. But on a deeper level, I think they were also afraid of the same thing that you and I are afraid of, which is losing control. Because when we have something that's concrete and tangible, such as an idol or a king, we might feel like we retain an element of control. And this is an illusion, of course, but the feeling is real. And with God, it's different. God is unwilling to be controlled by anyone. He told Gideon the same thing that he told Moses at the burning bush. "I will go with you. I will be with you. You will have my presence, but you will not control me." And that's, I think, what is so scary, what is so terrifying. Because it means we have to completely surrender control to God. And we have to acknowledge that we fully depend on God, and that there's nothing more contrary to our human nature or more offensive to our human pride than acknowledging that. But once you've acknowledged that God is king, like Gideon did, there's no more logical step to take. So that's why Gideon refused to be named king and took this stance against this human tendency towards slavery. But unfortunately, it didn't last long, and I'm sure you all know his son did declare himself king, and he had a very short-lived reign, which ended in disaster. And even though there was no king that followed him immediately after that, the pattern had already been set. So even though Gideon's son failed, it wouldn't be long before the monarchy was established in Israel, and the results were no less disastrous. And so that's part of the reason for me that the book of Judges is also so interesting, because it has sort of both It has a tension running through it. It's both pro-monarchy and also anti-monarchical. And especially in the beginning of the book, you have this idea or ideal of having no god but king, which is explored and celebrated and, as we've already seen, taken seriously. But on the other hand, the whole book of Judges is basically a slow but steady demonstration of the failure of this idea. And the book sort of is this descent into chaos, which is punctuated at the end in chapters 19 and 20 by these awful stories of lust and rage and violence and civil war. And throughout the second part of the book, we have this iconic phrase that rings sort of like a chorus that keeps showing up. There was no king in Israel. Every man did according to his own will. And so I think the conclusion that's usually drawn from the book of Judges in general, but also from this phrase specifically, is that this lack of justice and unity was a result of the fact that there was no king in Israel, that it was a lawless and primitive time, and it was barbaric, and it took the kings of Israel to come in and establish order and the rule of law. And that makes sense, because Judges was written after this period, when the monarchy had already been established, and the prevailing political opinion was in favor of having a king. But we know that it wasn't necessarily any better once they did have kings, especially in terms of justice and unity. The situation didn't magically improve just because they had a king. Just ask Uriah, like Danny spoke about last week, and many other examples of injustice done to people specifically by the king. But it does make sense to read the book of Judges in this way. I think even if it's maybe a bit revisionist, and it did serve to reinforce the legitimacy of the current political structure that God had opposed from the beginning. But it does make sense. But I just thought it could be possible that you could read this phrase differently. What if it meant something else? What if it was a lament mourning the fact that there was no king in Israel, not because they had not yet enthroned a human king, but because they had rejected their God who was their king and deposed the one who had liberated them and set them free? This is probably not the reading that the authors intended, but it actually makes quite poignant sense to read it in this way. What if the disunity, disorder, violence, and oppression that they were lamenting were not due to the fact that there was no king in Israel, but due to the fact that there was no king in Israel anymore? They thought that they were moving forward in choosing a king, trying to be like the other people, get with the times, you know, progress, but actually they were moving backwards, back towards Egypt, back towards slavery. God wanted to set them free. But part of the problem, I think, is that they didn't know what it meant to be freed by God. And we still don't know sometimes what it means. What does that look like? And so I think part of what it means is going back to what God originally intended, having the kind of relationship with God that he wanted to have with us from the beginning. Our rebellion through idolatry not only enslaved us when God intended to set us free, but it's also distorted the way that we view ourselves and the way that we view God. And getting back into the correct form of relationship with God and with ourselves is what salvation and restoration is all about. It allows us to become what God intended for us to be. And if God is our king, then the appropriate way for us to relate to him is as his subjects. And once we accept that, and we accept that model, then I think we're free to dwell in God's presence, and God is free to use us for his will. And that's what happened with Gideon. And it's one of the most striking things about this story, the thing that most people remember usually. Because in this story, as in many others in the Bible, God specifically chose someone who was weak, the weakest, to work through, just to make it absolutely clear that the victory was his, and it was won through his strength. He's sovereign, and he doesn't need us to accomplish his will, but he chooses to work through us. And so when Gideon was chosen in Judges 6, the angel of the Lord came to speak to him, and he was actually hiding when he came and spoke to him. And this is an interesting detail. I want to just read it really quick. This is Judges 6, 11 and 12. The angel of the Lord came and sat down under the oak in Ophrah that belonged to Joash, the Abiezrite, where his son Gideon was threshing wheat in a wine press to keep it from the Midianites. When the angel of the Lord appeared to Gideon, he said, "The Lord is with you, mighty warrior." So he was actually hiding in a wine press. I mean, you don't usually thresh your wheat in a wine press, I assume. So he was hiding, trying to keep the Midianites from seeing him and stealing his wheat. So it's an interesting detail, first of all, I think, just in terms of storytelling, because that's the kind of thing that you don't include unless you're familiar with this sort of situation, unless you really have been oppressed. You wouldn't think of including that sort of detail. But it also shows that Gideon wasn't a big, strong warrior. If anything, he was the opposite. He was hiding. And the angel calls him that. It's almost like a joke. And when you look at what happens after that, Gideon basically says that. He says, "I'm the smallest, I'm the weakest. How can I save Israel?" It's like he was saying, "Are you kidding? Look at me, I'm hiding. You want me to go fight?" But the truth is, God didn't need a mighty warrior to free his people. He needed someone who would recognize that he was king. And I also like to think that God recognized the potential in Gideon, and he knew what he was and what he could become better than Gideon himself knew. Because I'm sure Gideon never thought of himself as a mighty warrior, as someone that would free his people. But when someone sees potential in you and believes in you, it can have a big impact on the way you see yourself as well. And that reminded me of a story. Our former director at our hospital, he had a long career in the military. And he said in the military, you know, when you saw potential in someone, they would refer to them as the rank above the rank they actually had, to sort of, and a lot of times it would help them see themselves in a different way. And he started doing that in our hospital to different people, and including to me. He started calling me director, you know, before there was ever a hint that I would become the director. And it does. It changes the way you see yourself, and it can inspire. So I think Gideon was called by God. And another aspect that people always remember from the story is the signs, right? He asked God for signs, and God gave him all these signs. And usually there's a whole debate about that. Like, some people say Gideon asked for signs, so we should ask for signs. And other people say, no, you shouldn't test God. So I'm not really going to talk about that. But I do think it's interesting that God never got mad with Gideon when he asked him for signs. He did give him all the signs that he needed, and even more to convince him. And it was a process, I think. God called him a mighty warrior even when it wasn't true and he was hiding from his enemies. But God didn't abandon him. And he didn't abandon him when he kept asking for all these signs. And he didn't abandon him when, even after he had received all these signs, he was still too afraid to go tear down the idols. And so he did it at night, because he was afraid of his own people, not even the enemies, his own people. So who is this mighty warrior that can't even stand up to his own people and has to sneak out at night to do it? How is he going to go face the enemy? But God didn't abandon him. He kept working with him and encouraging him and strengthening him and calling him a mighty warrior until it became true, until Gideon really did become a mighty warrior and did liberate his people. And I think Gideon knew he wasn't ready to fight, but in the end, he didn't have to. And thankfully, we don't have to fight our battles either, because God is in control. And he demonstrated this in this story by doing probably the most militarily foolish thing imaginable. God sent away most of his army, and that was in Judges 7. And I just want to read one verse there, which is sort of the key in verse. It's verse 2, Judges 7:2. The Lord said to Gideon, "You have too many men for me to deliver Midian into their hands. In order that Israel might not boast against me, that her own strength saved her. So it doesn't matter how confident a general or someone is, they would never send away extra soldiers from a battle. But God wanted to do that to make absolutely sure that he is the one winning the victory. So I think when we learn to accept who we are and who God is, that is true liberation. And God is king, and we're his subjects. And once we realize that, we're free to become what God intended us to be. And that also kind of reminds me of my job that I do in Niger. When I first started the job, when I first accepted the job, we were living here, and it was as spiritual director. And everyone that I told, you know, everyone who was closest to me, my friends, my family, even myself, when I told them that I'm accepting this job as a spiritual director in a hospital, the initial reaction was laughter. They're just like, what? because they didn't see me in that role. And honestly, I didn't really see myself in that role. But I believe that God did. And it also, this sort of theme also reminds me of a patient who was at our hospital, a little girl who was born with cleft lip. And she was also born with a twin sister. So she came to the hospital with her mother, and they were identical twins, but because of her cleft lip, they didn't look the same. And she had her surgery, and she was very shy. Most of the kids who come are very shy because they're usually hidden away. It's like a shame on the family, so a lot of times they're hidden away. And even when they come to the hospital, sometimes they're covered up. Their faces are covered up, or their legs, if that's what's, if that's where the condition is, they cover the leg up. So they're sort of hidden away, and when they do come, they're very shy. But this girl had her surgery, and after that, she came back and saw her mother and her sister, and her mother said, "Now I see that she's her sister's twin." She was healed and restored and made into what God had intended her to be. It's like her true identity was revealed. And that's a transformation, I think, that we can all go through. We just have to turn towards God and be in the relationship that God intended for us. That's the basis of us, of it all. He calls us, and we turn away from him, just like Adam and Eve. But all we have to do is turn back, come back to him, and he will come back to us. And that's what salvation is, and the restoration of this broken relationship. And it's liberating, because we realize that when God is in control, we don't have to do everything on our own. And we can't anyway, but we keep trying. But when we realize that, finally, we can allow God to work through us. And it means we can stop being afraid and stop hiding, like this little girl was in hiding, or like so many of the other kids, and like Gideon was hiding in the wine press. We can step out into the light of God's love, because he is our king and he is with us. So let's pray. Dear God, thank you for this day. Thank you for this chance that we get to be together in your house and look at your word together. Thank you for your presence among us. I just ask that you would continue to bless each and every one of us, and help us to stand in your light and in your love, and show your love to those who are around us. In your name we pray. Amen.